Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here at WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you some ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And with me in the studio today is my good old dear friend Bernie Starr, who's back visiting us. Bernie, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here. Come on, it's getting to be a habit, but
getting
it's
to be a
good
habit. I love it. Well, you know, Bernie, I think the beauty of it is when I find someone like you who I can share thinking with. It's such a beautiful thing. I mean, I love to share thinking. I love to think through and not win or lose or know more than the other guy. And it brings us to our subject today, which is where people have tended to get more and more isolated. So I want to tell people, first let's talk a little about Bernie. Bernard Starr is the psychology professor at City University, a psychotherapist, and he now teaches spirituality and psychology in film at Marymount Manhattan College, and he's also the president of the very amazing organization called the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy, which puts together the whole idea of kind of soul and mind. You know, it just is I love the people who are involved in it. So he's also the main United Nations representative for the Institute of Global Education that founded the Muchela School in India. Escape Your Own Prison, Why We Need Spirituality and Psychology to Be Totally Free. Totally Free is what brought Bernie back to my attention. But then when we got talking, we understand that this is something that we're both concerned about for the people we know. Here's what's happening to folks. It doesn't look much better. It looks as if the purge, the thing that's taking place, is happening more and more. We're in it. You know, we're in it. And from what you see, closings of stores, closing of Best Buy, Starbucks, other places, everywhere you look, jobless claims are up, people are losing jobs. It looks pretty rough out there. So there's a couple of different ways of perceiving it. And one way that you could look at it, of course, is, oh my God, what's happening? I didn't think this would happen, as nobody did. I didn't anticipate the entire bubble would break so fast. My housing is down, my savings is down, my 1001, my 401k, my retirements, my mutual funds. I had some money saved to buy Christmas presents. I can't buy the kids Christmas presents. It's like people feel overwhelmed, and the news exaggerates it, and not it doesn't exaggerate it, but loves to put it in your face. Here it is, worse, worse, worse. So with all of that, when you think about people who are, I'm thinking about the people of the age group, which they call the baby boomers, but that 50 and over group, who thought that they had a good plan, and the plan is now not working. And what happens to them? Well, a funny thing happens. I've talked to quite a few men, and they don't talk to each other, especially the ones who are in retirement places. They don't say, I mean, except for the oy vey, look what happened. You know, there's usually it's not, and I'm okay, I'm taking care of myself. So that kind of leaves men to be isolated with themselves and what they say to themselves. So I'm going to have Bernie talk about this a bit because I think it's kind of important. But here's my bottom line, my friends. This is a time of cleansing. It is, I hoped in my lifetime I would see a time of cleansing that did not require a world war or nuclear war. Because that was the only other way we were going to get cleansed. Instead, we have our own kind of war. We have the falling apart of the illusion. And the cleansing, we are a part of the cleansing. Every bit of us, every bit of our excesses that we take away, every bit of it, we can say to ourselves, this is getting clean, and for one thing for sure, the children of the future will be more based in reality than we were over the last 30, 40 years for sure. Kids in the future are going to have a much better shot than we had, because we just kept building it up this way, and the matrix is falling. So, Bernie, I want to talk to you about this and how people deal with it, and how men deal with it, and how people, when they see themselves losing their dreams, their hopes, their aspirations, their futures, what can we do? What can we do to help them? And I'll leave it.
Well, first, Armand, I think there's no way of taking away the pain. There's no magical answer or solution that's going to just evaporate all of the pain. But then, of course, there are age differences, as you pointed out. For older people, there's always the feeling there's no more time for me to recuperate. You know, as a matter of fact, when FDR introduced Social Security, as he was signing the bill, he said this is to prevent poverty in old age, because when you have a recession, depression, whatever, it's much harder for people to recoup who are in the age bracket, the upper end of the baby boomers, or even older people. On the other hand, I've spoken to some young people who are very optimistic. They say, oh, wow, you know, this is really now an opportunity to get in, and they have a longer timeline. They're thinking 25 years ahead, so they have some optimism. But on the other hand, this entire collapse here almost seems like something of biblical proportions. And yes, I find many people who are kind of embarrassed that they've lost money, that things have fallen apart. But of course, there's the opportunity here for sharing, because almost everybody has been hit. You know, people who thought I had solid investments and, you know, my home was a good buy, I got it at a great price, and, you know, suddenly it's not. But everybody's kind of in the same boat, and I think that takes some of the edge off, so that people don't feel entirely alone. But I think that they're often preoccupied with the fear of the future.
Well, you make a few points there, Bernie. One point that you make, first of all, let's talk about the difference between youth and at a certain age. And youth is like when you're a kid, when you're very young, you have a different chemistry. You have a chemistry of recovery. You have a chemistry that says, I can take on challenges, I can take on battles, and your neurochemistry is built so that there's enough dopamine, acetyl, and neurotransmitters to help you through all the rough spots, because you're young and you're vibrant. You're like an animal that's out there in the Serengeti who could do it.
Also, their concept of time is different. I mean, young people often feel they have a tremendous amount of time. I have time to waste time.
That's right. They have a sense of time. Mm-hmm. A senselessness of time. No time limit. That's why you could smoke, because you're not going to get troubles. You know, that's why you could not think ahead of the future. But now that's one generation. Now there's another thing I believe happens to people as they get older, Bernie. I think when people get older, I think the design of the human being has been, as you get older, we prepare you for death. Well, that kind of natural. We prepare you for death. How do we prepare you for death? We tone you down a little bit. We take down some of your excitability. We take down your excitement. We stop having you attracted to exciting things. You tend to want to go to the more sedate things, the quieter things. You want guaranteed seats at places. And we kind of make it so that you, as you get older, take less energy out of your life because you have less resources. And getting older brings with it a kind of depression of the excitement. And I've always noticed that with people, as they get older, they tend to slide into what I see as an aging depression. And an aging depression looks just the way an aging depression looks. Sallow eyes, behind maybe a decent spirit, but the person is depressed. And there's a depression that you could say the natural depression of old age. The question that we have is that inevitable, number one? Is that just what we slid into as a result of building an economy the way we did and extending lives as far as we have? Is that just our assumption that people are just going to get that way? Do people fight against it by trying to be healthy and vibrant and they go to the gyms and all that? That's their war against mm-hmm. it. Or are we fighting something, a war that shouldn't be even bothered with at the beginning?
Right. Well, you know, war is a good term. And a lot of what you're talking about as you know, fear and depression in old age is really more apparent than real, at least according to the research. And my personal observations, you know, I also work with a television production company called Active Aging, in which we do stories about older people who are very active, vital, and some of them are quite incredible. And again, the research, too, says that a lot of the fears that you're talking about are on the other side of the trenches, you know, among the baby boomers and the older baby boomers. And that age range now is 44, that generation of 77 million is age 44 to 62. And that's where you find the tremendous anxiety and fear of aging. Yes, at 30, a wrinkle or a gray hair appears and the person gets, notices it and starts thinking about aging. But it's not until 40, and almost all of the commentators and researchers cite 40 as a turning point, and then it starts really looking serious, and that's when people start these regimens and whatnot at age 50. But these people are still climbing the ladder, and they're still looking to the future, and they're still building their careers. By age 50, they start thinking about, hey, I want time to slow down. You know, it looks like there is an end to time. And that's when they may start committing themselves to the diet and the herbs, the magical herbs, and liposuction, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the 100 different ways. Well, this incredible anti-aging industry, this multi-billion dollar, maybe trillion dollar anti-aging business. And then by 60, people start thinking, well, you know, maybe I'm not going to win this war. Or so, and they start thinking differently, and then the person retires, and they suddenly, although previously they felt time's running out, and I have to accomplish things, and I have to get things done, and then suddenly the person's retired, and they have time on their hands. They have too much time. They'll say they have time to kill. And then if you say to this person, hey, you know, why don't you take up something that you never had time for when you were climbing that ladder and you were very active? Why don't you take up a musical instrument? You're interested in music. That's what you want to do. And the person says, it's ridiculous. Why should I do that? How much time do I have left? You know, so a lot of this points out how we're caught up in this illusion of time and how we get whiplashed by it throughout our lives. And in fact, in my book, I make the suggestion, gee, how would it be if we just dropped out of time, if we got rid of that mental construction of time? You know, how would we live differently? And I think that that's what happens when people cross the trenches to the later years and they have to deal with what I call the real crisis of aging, which is when the ego meets its Armageddon, when that me, that idea of me that has to conquer the world, that has to master the world, that's invulnerable, and when that comes up against the brick wall of time, that there's no more time to accomplish that in the future, that's when a transformation takes place for many people. And that's why I think what you were suggesting, Armand, is that a crisis, whether it be the financial crisis or aging, when our illusions and fantasies break down, could be a very valuable window of opportunity.
Yes, and you know, the window of opportunity, Bernie, is for people to have a is to see it from a different framework. You know, the old framework isn't working. The old framework of as I had and therefore I'm going to do and I'm going to have my people take, you just tone it down a bit. You know, we're going to tone it down. Now, the trouble with this is the depression that comes as a result of people having these internal dialogues. And I think one of the first places we've got to start is to deal with these internal dialogues.
Well, yes, that's a big theme that I address in my book, the way we think about ourselves and the way we talk about our problems. And as we were discussing before, I mentioned about this acquaintance of mine who came over to me in a party some years ago, and he was looking very sad and he was teary-eyed, and he said and he had just broken up in a relationship and was feeling very lonely. And he said, I've had it. I'm cooling it with relationships now, and I'm just going to kind of withdraw and focus on myself, take care of myself, soothe myself, and generally be my own caretaker and focus on me. I'm going to be the main event. And I thought about that later, and I thought, gee, how peculiar this is, the way we talk about ourselves. Because in that conversation that he was having with himself, there were two characters. There was this person, and he was a very strong, successful person in the advertising industry, and he was going to, you know, he was a take-charge person. And here now is the hurt part that he's seeing, and he's going to take care of that, and he's going to soothe it. And how is he going to do it? First, he's going to withdraw, so he's going to make himself lonelier. So
the hurt part is like he sees himself as a fragile boy who is powerless.
Yeah, he's the, as John Bradshaw would call, the infant me and the little child me,
the helpless powerless me.
Yes, the helpless powerless me.
So he has this powerless me that he perceives, which is what he feels in his depression and his losses, and then he has another part of him that says, I got to take care of myself. I'll withdraw.
Okay, and the question that I ask then is, who is this I that is so powerful that it could take care of this other entity? And then, what is this entity? Now, you could experience that if you go into meditation and you just concentrate on that I. And we all experience this I am. And we all talk the way this person talks. We talk in fragmentation of ourselves, that we have these different parts. But if you get to that basic I and you sink into it, you become aware that, first of all, it's not a thing. You can't identify it. When you slip into it, your audience can try it. Just in a relaxed, meditative state, just get into that sense of I am-ness. And then tell me, what's the gender of that? What's the color of that? What's the age of that? And you'll find that you can't identify that, okay? That it's not a thing. But now, at the same time, this vast state of I am-ness, awareness, is looking at this other entity, the hurt child, now this person that I'm, this entity I'm going to take care of. Well, what's that? Where is that? And if I could look at that, if I could examine that, if I could observe that, then that's a thing. And where did that thing come from? Here I am, and that thing is over there. So that's a thing. And the more you think about it and you get into it, you'll realize that that thing is something that you created. It's something that exists in your mind. Yes, it may have come out of your personal experiences, and in your belief system, you decided that's who you were. So you started defending it, protecting it, because that's the only me, I, that you knew. Okay, but now we've discovered that, hey, there's something else there. There's this I am-ness, which is really me, and there's this object that I created. And if it's an object then it's that you created, then it's something that you could let go of. Okay. Now, that's where the problem comes in, because we know as therapists, easier said than done. In fact, one good analogy of that is, imagine yourself, hanging from a windowsill, okay, and you think it's a high floor, and it's a life and death struggle, and you're losing your grip, your fingers are bleeding, but you're determined to hang on because it's life and death. And then, by chance, you happen to look down, and you see you're 2 feet off the ground. Okay, you're not on the 25th floor. And in an instant, you just let go, and you're on firm ground, and you have a new foundation, and the other thing that was the whole center of your life is dropped. Okay, now, that, in a sense, is the relationship between, who we really are, the sense of I am-ness, and the characters that we create and we invest our lives in and are fearful of letting go of it.
Beautiful. What a beautiful image, too, because I could think of people as holding on to a ledge, And, it's a funny word, Bernie, because the word to know your ledge is the word knowledge, right? Know,
yes,
the ledge.
True.
Know,
yeah.
Ledge. Because most of us see the word we see ledge, and we think this is it. There's a big fall underneath us. We have to hold on. And I think most people are holding on to something. So now comes this very interesting point, Bernie, and I want to know what you think. This illusion of creating a hurt child, that we now has, that is now carrying the pain, must come as a result of us having developed a self that has been able to distance from the pain. So there's a self in me that doesn't feel pain because I'm an adult, I'm strong, I know how to go through things. And the pain that everybody has and the worries and the fears, you know, I've been through it all. That's one me. Then there's another me that gets scared. And now this is what I imagine. There's another me that gets scared, but it's not another me. You're saying, no, that's not another you. That's the you that gets scared that also takes care of things.
Right. It's all the same consciousness. Let me draw another picture of that. Okay, the audience can't see this, but I'm holding up my two hands. And let's say you were photographing this, filming it with a camera close up. And you see what appears to be three different entities, the two hands and the head. Okay, and let's say these hands are arguing with each other. This hand is saying, oh, you said that, and that hurt me, and you never addressed my needs. And the other one says, oh, but that's not true, and I did, but you did this to me. And you're familiar with these arguments. You hear them all the time. Okay, and now the head in the middle is mediating this, trying to bring, well, wait a second, let's calm down, let's discuss this, let's each talk about our hurts and our needs, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Now the camera moves back, and the camera gets to a certain point where suddenly you see, hey, wait a second, those two hands and the head, they're not separate entities. It's part. That's Bernie. You know, that's Armand. That's one entity. It's not separate entities. And immediately you would see the fraud in that interaction. But isn't that exactly what we do when we talk about our problems, that we fragment our consciousness into these different parts, you know, the inner child, the inner adolescent, the hurt this, the hurt that. But at the same time, there's this other part, this wise, observant entity called I Am-ness that is looking at all of this, and that is really the subjective me. That precedes all of that, and that in lodging yourself in that, this fragmentation disappears, just as when you move that camera back and see that the two hands in the head, it's not three different entities, it's one.
Beautiful. Bernie, you know, it reminds me, it seems that the trick here is to reintroduce the awareness that pain can be a part of potency, that you don't have to be impotent to feel the pain, and therefore what a person allows in, when they come back from the camera, they say, okay, and I hurt, and this hurt me, and yes, I lost something I believed in, I had to sell my house, and I will go through the pain of it.
Yes, and we don't want to trivialize that pain.
Right, but being willing to say, I am standing up, I am a caretaker, I can take care of myself, I can take care of that which is around me, and I could feel hurt and pain, and I could be there if the people around me feel pain. I don't have to stop them from feeling pain. We're in it together, and we could do it together. That's the kind of thing that harmonizes and brings the self together. Whereas separating the self and saying that pain part of me has to be put aside, or I'm going to take care of the pain part of you. Now, a lot of men feel that they've let their wives down. They've let their mates down. They've let their children down. Oh, I've got to pull you out of school. I can't afford to put you in the school anymore. You know, and a lot of people are doing that. A lot of people are feeling bad because they are no longer able to take away the pain of the people they care about. And somehow acknowledging it's not you, it's all right, you don't have to take away everybody's pain. You're allowed to feel your own pain. You're allowed to go through this. And by fighting against it, by trying to really work against it, by isolating yourself and beating yourself over the head for your choices, it stops you from being a part of the cleansing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know the old adage in treating people is that you can't change other people. I mean, a lot of people make that mistake. I'm thinking of a six-year-old Jacob in first grade, and he's smitten with a girl in his class, Kathy. Let's say her name is Kathy. And he said that he wanted to marry Kathy one day. He said, because by then she'll stop hitting. You know, well, you know, lots of luck. Or another a New Yorker cartoon where another 5 or 6 year old is tugging at a woman's skirt, and he says, you know, Mrs. Khan, Genghis is hitting me again. You know, so we all deal with that all the time, the problems of change. So I don't want to trivialize in making this distinction between the I am-ness consciousness and the characters that we create in the internal dialogues we have, because there's real pain there in the identification with those different fragments.
But there's just
one question.
Sure.
Can you just leap over it? Because a lot of people will say, oh, well, just, you know, meditate, get into that state of I am-ness, and this other thing is just a mental construction of yours, you know, and just drop it. These things come and go. Well, like with 6-year-old Jacob, you know, that you'll just automatically change at some point, or that you could leap over these issues, is one of the things that we have to deal with all the time, because in practice we find you can't.
Well, what I find in practice is that when a man finally gets to meet with me, and I'm talking about men specifically, but it's men and women, it's everybody, but when a man meets with me and he finally finds that he's in a safe spot where he could unfold it, one of the things that I encourage him to do is unfold the part of him that's in pain. Go, let's go through it. Let's get through this part of you that's part of you. It's part of what's going on here. Let's talk about your sadness. Let's talk about your, you know, it's like it's a death of sorts. It's taking place. Let's go through it. Let's go through the feeling of it and then come out the other side, because what people are doing is they're isolating their pain part and they're pushing it aside like it doesn't exist.
Right, exactly.
And they're just feeling it in private. So one of the natural things for people who are used to being in control to do is to withdraw, but not to withdraw to take care of themselves, but to withdraw to repress themselves, to shut down further. They just want to shut down information, and they want to get less, and that's what kind of depression is, you know? Depression is to get more and more depressed. Withdrawal and taking care of yourself or retiring is a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
And one has to be cautious when they say to themselves, well, I'm just moving back into a place where I could take care of myself. Very often, that's a way of saying, I'm just going to move myself into a closet where I could go to sleep.
Well, you'll wind up just wallowing in those emotions. I mean, that's what we found out when years ago we were doing primal therapy.
That's right.
That it was, you know, easy to get people into these deep feeling states and to relive traumas, real traumas that they had, and those were very real. But how do you get out of that? You mentioned before about coming out at the other side of the tunnel, and I think that very often these techniques don't have a tunnel to get out of, that they believe that just...
They have a lake.
Reliving these, right. The catharsis, and you keep going back there, that somehow that dissipates it. But often it intensifies it rather than dissipating it. And that's why you, from my perspective, you need this other concept of the I am-ness consciousness. Yes, experience it to the fullest. Find out those things that made you believe who you think you are. And from that point of view, we would look at the past and our traumas and all of these pains that we suffered, present and past, as who we are not. Okay? To discover who we are not. If you do it to discover who you are, you're going to be lost in it. How are you ever going to... If you say, that's who I am, okay, I'm this hurt child, then how are you going to get out of it? If you say, I came to believe I was the hurt child, that's another story.
This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Bernard Starr. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back from our break, we will be... I think it's time to play some really gentle music, my friends. It's time to soothe your hearts. We'll be back with you in just a couple of seconds. Thank you. Kiri Tikanawa. Kiri Tikanawa from the Opera Tosca. Armand Amelia with you with The Positive Mind. I'm bringing you something soft because it's a soft time. And it's a soft time because here's an interesting concept, you know. We are in the world of unmasking. Unmasking illusions. Illusions that have been there for years that, of course, WBAI has been striking at for years saying, it's an illusion, it's an illusion, it's an illusion, you watch out. And, you know, nobody wants to listen to WBAI. They want to listen to Fox News, and they want to hear about how you got to grab oil and, you know, put it in your basement because the price is going up so fast. So people would much rather be in the illusion because the illusion has immediate rewards. It has little rewards, little flavors, little tastes. You can go on trips. You could buy better steaks. You could have your famous sardine sandwich whenever you want. That's a delicacy to some people. But you could, you know, the idea is we would rather buy into a mass kind of collective illusion of wealth and security, which was always an illusion. Now, Bernie said something before that was really important. Most of the people who reach the age of retirement have, and the people who were able to do it did put money aside, and most of them who die have that money die with them, and they pass it on to somebody or to the government. So what were they thinking? What was all that time about? What were they saving it for? What was it? What was the illusion of saving it? The illusion of wealth and security. And that brings us to where we are right now. We're in a place where the illusions are starting to fall, and as we look at them, when we look at something like Best Buy in Circuit City, well, what were those shops? Those were shops that ran on a bare minimum profit. This is like the guy who sells grams of food when he makes a sandwich. They had just a gram of profit. They had just a little bit of profit in there, and they could sell many. That didn't work. That didn't work. So now we're going to try some other scheme. All these other things that didn't work, the Starbucks thing, didn't work. It never did work. You know, it's all kind of interesting. The illusions are kind of moving down one at a time.
And well, also, I think that illusion is very much the ego's game.
Okay, let's talk about that.
The me game, because the illusion is really about power. Okay, that if I have all these things, and if I'm going to get more in the future, I'm going to be this powerful, invulnerable ego. And then suddenly you get a crash, or you face the end of time, and you suddenly realize that this me self is not invulnerable, that there is an end. So it breaks that illusion very much, and I think that causes a lot of pain, because as you just pointed out, few of us ever use the resources that we have. Not even a fraction of it. Often, I mentioned this cousin of mine who used to say, he used to say to his mother, who said, "Oh, she's going to leave all of this to him," and he would say, "You better spend it, because if you leave it to me," he said, "in 2 weeks it's going to be gone." You know, the thing that you saved all of your life for.
Because he's going to spend it.
Yeah, he said he was going to spend it. So, and he was trying to tell you better use this. Now, he was trying to encourage her to use it because he was addressing this illusion that we have all of this stuff and things that we accumulate, but that we never really bear the fruits of it.
You know, Bernie, there's always been this question. Back in the 80s came up the question of the Age of Enlightenment. And we were looking at what enlightenment was and enlightenment was. I have a funny perception of the world, and I know that this is probably going to get some reactions. I believe the turn of the century, the millennium, the turn of the century was a very, very important time. I think that 2000 was an important time. I think it almost augured in time of cleanse. I think the attack on the World Trade Center was the beginning of the cleansing, because it broke through the first illusion. We are safe. We cannot be touched. And with that, slowly but surely, even though it looked like the world was recovering and the economy was booming, we went into the Bush years, which were unopposed aggression. And we go into the, we're now in these Bush years, and it's almost like somebody struggling for life. Almost like we had to elect George Bush to have him do this last death demonic thing to get the world to kind of see it. And what happened was the world did look, and they said, oh, no, you don't. And not only that, but after 8 years of it, the world said, stop, 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 no more. And when they finally said no more, the gas kind of came out. Mm-hmm. You know, the balloon kind of came out. But I think it started in 2000. I think it's like, I hate to make it a religious year, but I think the Age of Enlightenment really started in the year 2000, 2001. That we had the whole, this is all part of that picture. And if we're lucky, if we are really, really lucky and we go through this well, we're going to start with a cleanliness that is going to be just exquisite. The air is going to be clean. The air is going to be clean because we won't be burning as much fuel in the first place.
And also, just to follow up on what you're saying, we know that one of the few things that reliably produces change is crisis. Okay, that most people, we were talking about change and how people don't change in your certain way as a child. You meet the person 50 years later, the appearances may have changed, the person may be now rich or poor or whatever, but the same jerk, you know, or the same loving person, that you know, people don't change. But the one thing that does reliably produce change is crisis, like the near-death experience. We know that people make radical changes in their life. And you talked about the George Bush election. At that time, we thought the Bible, people thought, and he got into power on that he was going to bring the Bible into the White House, and that the conservative right was, and all their moralistic principles were going to save us. Okay. Now, noticeably, in this election currently, even though there was a lot of vicious interchange, the Bible was not one of the big issues. I mean, so it played that out. People realize that's not the salvation, you know, that we need something else. And now with the financial crisis and people having to deal with that, it really could be very much a window of opportunity for people to, you know, reassess their values, reassess their concept of reality, of life, you know, and who am I?
You know, the illusion, I think what you're saying as well, is that the change comes about out of crisis. But the change that usually comes about out of crisis is usually panic change initially. We don't have to be in crisis to create change is probably the lesson that somehow our ego self or our self has to learn. Some of us believe that it's only crisis that will motivate us to change. And what you could do, and what I'm hoping to develop, is a group of people and a world of people that can say, yes, the crisis is an illusion, and that we are inviting change and welcoming ourselves as a part of that change. I am not going to say that I can, because I can't get a job, that that's an illusion. The pain is true. The pain is real.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole thing is a big illusion. The whole thing from the beginning that's busting, wealth, security, all of that, it's all, if it busts, we all get down to being equal and e pluribus unum, you know, we'll come out of it or something.
Well, and history tells us that life goes on, and also, unfortunately, people forget, though, you know, the crises come and go as well, and people go back to square one.
Stock market recovers, everybody goes right back, which they did right after the...
But illusion is a very big factor in life. In fact, did I ever tell you about the time I found out I'm bigger than Superman?
No, tell me about that.
Okay. Well, and I was very small as a child, the smallest one in the class, and it was very painful coming back each year in September to see if... Because they used to line you up in size places, and I was always the first in line. In fact, I was even before one of my classmates was Buddy Beam. You know, remember Mayor Beam?
Yeah.
Who was very tiny. Well, he had a son who was like him. And And he was second in line. I was first in line.
My God, you're really little.
Okay. So, that went on, and then I had a growth spurt, and I'm, fairly normal size, not as big as you, Armand. Okay. Okay, fast forward. I was doing a book tour much later in life, and I was in Boston, and with the Barbara Brilliant show, and it was because I'd written this book on sex and in later life, so they had this guy on, Mayo Khan, who was the model for Superman for the cartoon, and I guess they had him on because he was this powerful looking guy. He still operated a gym outside of Boston, looked fantastic, and he was the original model for Superman, and they had the posters there on the stage with him with the cape and everything, and the little kids there looking up to him, whatnot. A Jewish Superman too. Mayo Khan was his name. It's an interesting Superman story that few people know about. Okay, the show went well. We get up at the end, as you usually do on these talk shows, to talk to each other. And I get up, and Superman gets up, and I'm towering over him. The guy was 5'6". It was all illusion in those posters. And I thought, gee, if anybody had told me when I was in kindergarten, first grade, second grade, do you know that someday you're going to be bigger than Superman? That might have been a life-changing event.
Well, Bernie, see, I think that's what we're learning. We're learning that we are bigger than our problems, and we have the opportunity to learn that we're bigger than our fantasies and our fears. And here's what it calls on now. Now it calls on, and I need to go with you about the exploration of this concept of ego again. The ego self, the self that is identified by how I produce, what I have, my materialistic goals, my achievements, my mates, my everything around me, that's who I am. I am these things. That self, after a while, begins to peel away. And if you peel it away...
It's a time bomb. Okay, that eventually it's going to come up against that brick wall. Unless you have an extraordinary amount of luck in your life. I mean, the ego can work. I mean, let's be truthful about it, that if you happen to be lucky, you're lucky in love, you're lucky in work, your kids turn out okay, you're healthy throughout your life, and you don't face major crises, because, unfortunately, it's crisis that often does get us to change, you might squeak through with the ego. But the fact is that most of us are not that lucky, and that we will find crises all along, and that ego and its assumptions about invulnerability and power and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is going to have cracks in it, and it's not going to work. And then you get to its Armageddon, aging, where it just falls apart completely because it needs the future. The big pillar of the ego is the future, because that's where my greatness will be accomplished. That's where I will fill the hole, that hole that the ego has. The ego is always on the go. It's all, as one Tibetan Rinpoche said, Tarthang Tulku, the ego, it's always up to something. It's never satisfied. You reach one plateau and you take a deep breath and you say, yes, I've made it. And then, boom, that hole reappears and you're marching again until you reach the end of time.
What happens when you have, as you begin to let go of that concept of yourself, as you begin to let go of the whole idea of the future, what happens? Can you settle into a present? How do you settle into a present when you've got to worry about paying the rent next week? How do you do it, Bernie? How do you settle in when the stuff starts getting to you? When, the economy gets to you and you can't pay your rent.
Well, that goes on. I mean, you have to deal with that no matter where you are, where your consciousness is. There's the real world to deal with, the relative world. I'm not sure that you deal with it any more effectively out of panic or through the ego than with a sense of wholeness and some kind of sense that, yes, I can do, I can survive, and the recognition that things come and go, that everything comes to pass eventually.
And I am here. If any of you who love someone or have someone close to you could hold their hands and put the newspapers at your feet, and you could have one newspaper saying, Wall Street crisis crashing, Obama elected on another one, and put them at your feet and hold hands and look at each other silently and not say a word, but just exhale together and be present. If you can make the present connection with your family, with your kids, without words, to be here now with people, that makes that solid. That makes that connection between you and your real part, you know, more solid. You must spend time being present. If you don't spend any time being present and you're always in the future or always in the past, it won't work. Past is always regrets. Whenever anybody has a regret, it's thinking in the past. Whenever anybody has a fear, it's thinking in the future. Past is regret. Fear is future. The present is here now. And even though it's a cliche, it is our gift. It's a present. They hand it to us. They say, here, right now, my friends. You like listening to that music? Stop doing paperwork and listen to the music. Give yourself a minute. Give yourself a little time to find the solid part of you, because no matter who you are, it's in you. You've got it. And if you have a solid part of you that ever takes care of anybody, find that solid part of you, because it's available to you. And don't think you have to take care of yourself, because there is no self to take care of. It's all you.
Or stick to that part that is the part that is taking care of, because that's where the real power it comes from. And if you can recognize that and have that sense of wholeness, then you could be comfortable in the now moment. The problem with the now moment for the ego is that to relax in the now moment, and that's why a lot of people have trouble meditating even, to be in the now moment means I'm here, I'm now, this is it, this is the only reality. But then there's that hole there that I have to face. And the minute you sense that, the trajectory takes you into the future, that you want to just run from that now moment. So, you know, while you're trying to capture that now moment, you have to also begin to work on and capture that whole I am-ness, that powerful part that we spoke of before, the one that is going to take care of the hurt child and all the hurts within.
Do you recommend, do you think that the answer to all of this, Bernie, is to find a center, or do you think it requires, I think you need to have somebody who is willing to be with you in the present. Now, I think very often if you're a caretaker and you take care of people, you can't really be present with them. I think men need friends. I need women need friends. And I think they need somebody close to them who they can talk to and be real with. And as they have this realness, their friends are not necessarily going to feed the sick part of them. The friends are going to help them see who they are and remind them of their strengths, but just by being present. You know, I think about sweat lodges, you know, that they do sometimes, where you put a bunch of people in a sweat lodge, and all they do is sweat together. The Indians do it, and the Native Americans do it. And the idea is to feel the power beyond the words and everything else that is going there. So I think people need to have someone. Now, what would be wonderful is if you could have it in family. If you could have it in a friend, that would be grand. But if your friend is advising you and telling you what to do, that's not the idea. If the kind of friends you've chosen are the kind of people who kind of tell you what to do, or people who are subservient to you, that's not the idea. The idea is to have a real connected friend. If you can't find a connected friend, then do it with a consultant. Do it with a psychologist. Get someone like Bernie or me to talk to, because at least have somebody, have some place that you could empty this load. And then, if you want to go one step beyond that, then you form a group of men. And when you have a collective of men who are working together in an honest, beautiful way to be real, that's really fabulous stuff. So I think we have a men and women, of course.
I think it's very important to have... I would favor a consultant, because for most people, I mean, unless somebody really has self-knowledge and self-insight and can really be self-critical, most of us can't. And I think generally we pick our friends and the people who are close to us because they support our illusions. We pick people who have the same illusions or delusions, and that makes us feel safe and kind of validates who we are. So, and I think the way of breaking through that is to have an independent voice, consultant, or whoever. Otherwise, we just keep going around in the same circle and never make any real progress.
There is something about hanging out with somebody you're close to where you're just back-to-back and you're not talking. And you're just being there, you know, Bernie. There is something about it. There is something about just being present, you know. Going fishing without killing fish. You know, just being together with somebody is really an essential thing. People forget all about it.
Well, yes, especially if you could feel something that is beyond the words that that person conveys. In fact, last night I was giving a seminar, showing a video of somebody who was very powerful, and somebody in the audience said, "Well, I've heard all that stuff before, but that wasn't what was important. It was the person himself being with that person."
This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Bernard Starr. Thank you, Bernie. Thanks so much for being with us again. Hopefully you come back again next week. I want to continue.
My pleasure, Armand.
Here with Bernard Starr, president of the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy, author of the book. What's the name of the book?
Escape Your Own Prison, Why We Need Spirituality and Psychology to Be Truly Free.
Back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. Some interesting perceptions about the obsessive-compulsive personality and personality disorder. Some very, very new stuff that we're going to be presenting. So I'll be with you tomorrow at 1. If you want to get in touch with Dr. Bernard Starr, you can go to my website, thepositivemind.com. I will forward him the information. And I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friend. Send an email. Tell me how you like the show. And he had the back with you tomorrow at 1.